Welcome back to the Ethnographic Eater. Today we're going to do something a little bit different. Today we are having our first ever full book discussion. We have Dr. Ken Kolb here from Furman University discussing his book, Retail Inequality, The Food Desert Debate. Without further ado, let's jump in.
Welcome to the show, Dr. Kolb. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited.
So before we get into the pressing questions, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you find yourself involved with food or food research.
Well, I am a professor of sociology here in South Carolina. I teach at a school called Furman University. It's in the city of Greenville. And I have studied a number of different topics over my career. My first book was on victim services, more specifically what it was like for men to work inside a rape crisis center. And for my next book, I was working with some neighborhood associations for some problems that they were having. And I asked them what was the issue that was affecting them the most. And so I kind of let them pick the topic for my next book. And so that's what I try to do now is more community-driven stuff that I work with neighborhood residents, and I try and see the world from their point of view and equip them with data to press their local leaders for change.
You started this research in 2014, I do believe, and ended around, was it the first year of COVID?
Yep.
So it was a really lengthy process. Other than kind of asking your neighbors and doing this community work, were there any other passions behind writing the book?
I've always been really interested in food. I was born and raised in New Orleans, Louisiana. And I was also, in a prior version of my life, a volunteer for the Peace Corps. And I was stationed in Paraguay. And I was an agricultural Peace Corps volunteer. I was basically a farm extension agent and a beekeeper. And so I lived on a farm, raised pigs, chickens, grew vegetables. So I've always been connected to food. But even back then, saw that even though I was living in an area that was great at growing food, there were still big disparities in terms of who had access to the healthiest kinds of food. And so food access, the role and relationship of food to people's lives has always been really an important issue to me.
So this book is all about using your research to debunk the myths behind the food desert debate and getting down to the real conversation, retail inequality. Retail inequality is deeply rooted in racism and historically racist policies and actions kind of put into place by big corporations. This book isn't just about food retail, but it's about retail in general and how to bring an equal opportunity for good retail back into some neighborhoods. You've done interviews with your neighbors, you said, in order to understand their strategies and needs. We have a few questions about your face-to-face conversations. How did these interviews really make you feel?
Well, the type of research I do is primarily talking to people, participating in events with them, trying to understand the world from their point of view. I ended up interviewing about 100 people, hour-long interviews at their kitchen tables, on their front porches, just asking them how, where, why, when they bought and prepared and ate food. It's a very personal topic to reveal to people what you eat, but it's also something that we can all relate to. I don't always have the greatest dietary practices. And so being able to share those can kind of get people to feel a little more comfortable about telling me what's in their cupboard. But it really is a lens to understand people, the circumstances they're in. And so it's, you really get to know people. And the type of feeling when the interview goes well is a real kind of connection, is that you're not just asking somebody to fill out a survey on a piece of paper and then you take it back and you enter the results into a spreadsheet. The people I interviewed are still in my mind as actual human beings with stories and faces and names and histories. And writing about them was, in a way, telling their story and sharing with the world how they were trying to just make three meals a day work.
Did these interviews impact you in a way that you didn't really foresee?
There were a number of times when I interviewed people who were in pretty dire straits. I did interview one gentleman. I later learned he was in his 50s, but he easily could have passed for someone in their 70s. He was partially blind. He was living on food stamps, and the circumstances of his living arrangement were quite uncomfortable to him and me. And so it was sad, but it was also a snapshot into his resiliency and innovation and capacity to come up with really novel strategies to find the resources he needed. And so to see the world from the perspective of others opens you up to expand beyond my own privileges and benefits that are afforded to me on a day-to-day basis. And so it gave me a richer understanding of the world. It made me sad sometimes, but that's life. I mean, that's the way it is.
Going into chapter two, you start talking about your methodologies that you use in order to provide the backstory and facts for your book. Can you kind of go into that a little bit?
There's a couple of different methodologies I employed that were a little bit expanding on what I had normally done. So in general, I'm an ethnographer. I interview people. I participate with them in their lives and activities. But what I also did in this for this project was I did do some survey research. We went to a local food startup grocery that was situated within a food desert or an area without grocery stores. And I wanted to see how many of their customers were actually coming from the neighborhood in which they were located. And so we would get people's proximate addresses, not their actual address, but maybe like a street corner near them, plot those out on a map and calculate the distances to come up with an average distance that people were traveling, which was much farther than the 1 mile radius of the store. I also read a lot of newspaper articles. I did a survey of about 450 newspaper, radio, TV broadcasts about anything that addressed the issue of what was called food deserts at the time, to try and understand sort of the conventional wisdom or zeitgeist of what people were saying and thinking about this concept. And I mapped out all those articles and tried to find trends and assumptions for right or wrong. And then also just a general survey of the literature, of just looking through everything that was written in an academic publication about this concept for the past 15 years to kind of understand how we had great hopes that we had kind of solved this puzzle, that we knew how and why people ate the way they did. But then slowly over time, we came to see that maybe those early research findings didn't pan out once we collected more and better evidence.
The first four chapters, you heavily focused on breaking down some huge food retail myths, one of the most popular being that longer distances from the store to residencies must have an impact on diet. Can you go over some of the reasons why or how some of the interviewees found grocery shopping difficult?
Yeah, I mean, distance is a problem. If you really are far away, it adds transportation costs to get there in terms of gas, wear and tear, as well as time, which can cost you in terms of not being able to work if you're spending lots of time trying to get to and from the store. But when I talked to people, I came to understand that even though there weren't grocery stores close to where they lived and where they slept at night, their daily lives brought them across the city for a number of reasons where they crossed paths with stores quite frequently. Whether it's going to work or worship or to see friends or family or to go to healthcare appointments or to seek out social services, they were having to go places. And on the way to and from those places, they usually cross paths with a store. But the ability to go to a store requires a lot of variables coming together at the same time. One, to make a trip worth it, they needed to have time afterwards to be able to do something with this food that they were going to buy. Two, to go to the store and to buy some ingredients, fresh fruits, vegetables, whole cuts of meat that required some kind of preparation at home, usually meant in order for it to be worth it, they had to, what I found was, have a particular set of household dynamics in order to make home cooking worth it. So it wasn't so much getting to the store that was the problem, although some people do face difficulties getting to the store. It was the decision to buy healthy food at the store that would make sense for them. So what I found was that people in households with a number of people, so other adults or kids, as the number of mouths that needed to be fed increased, so did the incentive to actually cook from scratch, because you can save a lot of money by preparing raw ingredients and fashioning them into a meal. Food that's prepared outside the home or pre-cooked or par-cooked that just requires reheating or putting in the stove or putting in the oven, that stuff is more expensive because there's labor involved in all that preparation. It's cheaper, but it's also faster. And so for people who lived alone, to cook a big meal, not only wasn't that attractive because it took a long time, they were the only person who was going to have to finish off all the leftovers of that meal for potentially the week to come. So I like lasagna, and I like to cook lasagna for my family, and we can maybe tolerate maybe two rounds of leftovers. But if I cook a big lasagna for myself, then I'm staring down the barrel of maybe seven nights in a row of the same meal. And that's not so attractive. And that applies to everyone, rich and poor. And so one of the things that I really learned was that seeking out convenience foods wasn't something that people did because they were misinformed. It was because it was actually quite a logical way to save time and money. because the savings that you can accrue by cooking from scratch are sometimes offset by the amount of time spent doing it. You know, we got to remember that in the United States, fast food consumption goes up with wealth. Wealthy people have all sorts of awful diets in our country. And I'm not saying my diets are perfect either. It's by having a steady job and a steady salary, I have access to adequate housing, healthcare, education for my children, and I can give them the things that we can do to sometimes offset our lousy diets. But if you're living in poverty, you don't have necessarily the benefits of great housing, healthcare, and education. And so that exacerbates maybe the less than healthy food that you're eating. So in general, I found that getting to the store, while it was inconvenient in many ways, it was the calculations once people got to the store that was a greater factor in determining what they were going to eat and whether or not they were going to invest a lot of time to prepare it.
So are there any more that you think should be added that you may not have included in your research?
Well, I think I did address the power of advertising and the power of commercial interests trying to convince us what we should want to eat. I addressed that primarily in the section where I explained the phenomenon of kid food in the United States. And this was a real problem for single parents, is because their kids would demand certain kinds of food that most often was kind of chock full of salt, sugar, and fat. And so it was hard to refuse them because kids can really be very picky eaters sometimes.
Oh,
and can
yeah.
make parents' lives very difficult in a variety of emotional strategies. But also that, you know, in the United States, we've convinced ourselves and our children that there's a whole separate set of foods set just for kids. And so, you know, I go to a restaurant and I don't expect to have a unique menu that's tailored just for me as a customer. But kids do, and they can, because there's a kid's menu, and they can demand stuff that's not even in the realm or theme of what a restaurant is serving. Most every family-style restaurant has chicken fingers or chicken nuggets or grilled cheese or some kind of variation on those available to kids, no matter what the restaurant serves. And so this became really challenging for parents, because if they were with kids, they were living together, but eating separately. They were, and many times, preparing a separate meal for their kids. And that's not really the way it happens in every country in the world. In other parts of the world, children do eat slightly different foods, but it's mostly in the consistency and quantity and portions. It's smaller, maybe it's made easier to eat or chew, but it's generally the same food with the same ingredients. But by the advertising campaign of food corporations and being able to convince children and their parents that kids' tastes aren't ready for adult foods, we put a lot of pressure on parents, and this creates a real economic bind for them, because if they want to feed their kids really healthy food, it might be slightly less sweet or salty or fatty. It might even be bitter in the terms of like greens. With that, once you start deviating from the kid food template, then the possibility that your kid might refuse that food. I mean, if they're a toddler, they might just throw it on the floor. Or if they're a 10-year-old, they might just throw a tantrum. That incentive, that possibility of them refusing it increases. And that's not just an emotional issue. That can be a cost issue. Because if the kid isn't eating the food, then that's wasted money literally down the drain. And so for parents living in poverty, the potential risks of kids refusing food can have serious economic consequences. And so if there was anything that I had to do over again with the book, would be to dig deeper into the advertising campaign in coordination with the retail food industry to sort of convince us what we should be eating, given that in other parts of the world, eating is done in a very different manner.
So moving forward into kind of chapter 3 and chapter 4, you mentioned that it's really easy for media outlets and news channels to confuse the terms food desert with other terms like food waste, food justice, and food access. You mentioned that this kind of leaves readers confused as to what food deserts are really all about. What are some ways you think anyone could eliminate any confusion that these terms don't always coincide?
Well, yes, there are a number of food-related movements that get confused and conflated with one another. The term food desert itself was coined in Scotland in the 1990s. It came over to the United States. It became the centerpiece of some large food-related legislation, most in particular, the Healthy Food Financing Initiative. And the USDA originally defined it for urban areas as being neighborhoods with high rates of poverty, low rates of vehicular access, and no major grocery stores within a mile radius. Now, there's problems with that definition, and people call it different things now. The term food apartheid has come on the scene, and it offers a more accurate portrayal of the systemically racist housing and highway policies that created the retail landscape today. But we still, even when we call it food apartheid, it still gets conflated with issues with other food-related movements, like some of those that you just mentioned. And the problem, well, one of the reasons that we can understand this conflation, even though food insecurity and food waste are related with food apartheid or food deserts, but they have different root causes and they require different solutions. One of the reasons why they all can get cobbled together is that it strengthens the collective movement around food issues, is that people who are trying to fight the issue of food waste or for advocating for grocery stores in food deserts, if they can align their forces, they can increase the total amount of political capital they have and the possibility that they can get things done. And so everybody that I interviewed wanted a nice grocery store to come to their side of town. Now, wealthier white residents wanted a Whole Foods or a Trader Joe's because they wanted access to those more high-end healthy amenities. Less wealthier residents may not have been as interested in the organic products, but they still wanted to save time and money and not have to travel far away to go to the store. And so long as they both agreed that a grocery store would be a good thing for the neighborhood, even though they had different sort of, they were coming from different areas in terms of maybe the problems that they were trying to solve, they both could agree on the solution. This is when disparate social movements can combine forces and get stuff done, even though when they really talk to each other, they're kind of at odds. I mean, people who are advocates for organic foods, in a way, arguing for higher priced foods. And those who don't have as much economic resources, those higher priced foods are going to be out of reach and not something they really want. Now, grocery stores can sell both. They can sell conventional food and organic food. So maybe both those groups can come together and just say, well, we want a grocery store. But the origins of their complaints and what they really are trying, the problems they're really trying to solve, when you put them in a room together and you really get them talking, you might find out that they don't agree with each other as much as some might assume.
Okay, so throughout the book, you mentioned that there are multiple instances where primarily poor neighborhoods, as well as primarily Black neighborhoods, were affected by injustices. Can you give us a brief history, starting from the closing of textile mills, on how this led to urban decline?
Right. So textile mills were the engine of the economy in Greenville, South Carolina, all the way up to the 60s. And then the slow implosion began in the 70s and 80s. In other parts of the country, the industries were different. So Flint, Michigan, it was cars. Youngstown, Ohio, was steel. And if you look at the origins of how cities were constructed or the rationales for why they were built in the first place, most American cities were built around work. There were factories or industries of some sort that required lots of people coming together to create some type of product, drawing them in from the countryside or rural areas so that they would concentrate together to collectively cooperate and accomplish some kind of work task. Again, that could be pouring steel, that could be building cars, or in the case of Greenville, textiles. So in the 70s and 80s, there was this slow decline. And then by the 80s and 90s, the United States, as a government policy, effectively decided to get out of the manufacturing business. Not altogether, but at least to try and focus our economy on different types of jobs that primarily required more education. Some of these products could be built cheaper elsewhere in other parts of the world, and even accounting for transportation costs and shipping costs, brought back here and be more cost effective. So this had implications for those cities that were built around those kinds of work. Once the jobs went away, then you had a real problem. There wasn't a whole lot of desire to live into the city center because there weren't as many jobs as there were before. At the same time, the United States government got into in the post-World War period, building out the infrastructure for suburban development. So suburban development in the post-World War II era required big highways to get people outside of town quickly. It required infrastructure in the terms of electricity, power, communications. All this stuff cost hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, and it enabled people in cities that were declining, an outlet. It literally paved the way to the suburbs. And when people left for the suburbs in the United States, it was primarily white households in a phenomenon that urban scholars call white flight. They left for the suburbs and they took their spending money with them. And so in the city centers, all the mom and pop and corner stores that were left had fewer customers. And because the wealthier customers left, the customers that remained couldn't afford to support those stores in the ways that they could before. So you see a real strain and stress put on smaller retail outlets in city centers. And then sort of the final 1-2-3 punch is the big box storeification that hit American retail in the 70s and 80s. So facilitated by these large highways that could tap into global supply chains, retail outlets could build really large stores that didn't have to sell at high prices because they could sell so many products at a given time. So this is a business model based on volume, not price per item. And we see this with Walmart, Home Depot, Target, whatever type of store that you're thinking of, big box store, they all produced a lot of pressure for small Main Street and where people used to shop. And so this really hit the hardest in Black neighborhoods throughout the United States because one, they lacked the resources to be able to just pick up and move to suburban communities in the way that their white counterparts do. In the early days of suburban construction, they were prohibited because of racist and exclusionary housing policies from moving into those new white enclaves. And so they were left to stay in city centers where there was very few public or private sector investment. And so this is basically the story of how what we come to know today as the poor Black neighborhood was essentially a creation of post-World War II housing and highway policy. And so this affected them with all forms of retail, not just food, hardware, merchandise, banking, but food is the one thing that people cannot go without. If you can't get to Target, that's unfortunate, but we don't see that as a serious problem. But food, especially once it becomes as a public health issue, the agenda of priorities of things to fix. And so that's sort of the story of how areas that we refer to as food deserts or food apartheid today weren't just happenstance or bad luck. They were actually policy creations.
Since we touched a little bit on how food deserts kind of became more of a public health issue, and we also had other food movements behind it to back it, you mentioned that food, when talking about food deserts and healthy food and bringing grocery stores in, should be seen as a symbol. Can you give us a little insight as to why?
Yeah, I mean, it's a symbol of investment. It's a symbol that your side of town matters. And so the thought experiment I usually walk students through is to have them remember a time when they drove into a new town or a new area that they'd never been to before, and they show up at night. And it's late at night, and there's no one is around. So you can't actually tell the composition of the neighborhood. You can't look at people and determine whether or not this is a rich neighborhood or a poor neighborhood because of the clothes or the cars that people are driving. What do you look for? And you look to the storefronts. And so you come into town, are there nice cafes? Are there yoga studios? Are there high-end barbershops? Or are there pawn shops and liquor stores? Do the stores have bars on the windows? What kind of products are they selling? And so we look to retail as a symbol of the collective wealth of the people who live just behind the commercial corridor. What are the kinds of stuff that they want to buy or that they can buy? And so retail matters. It's not trivial. I mean, it is a product of our capitalist society, but that's where we're at. And so people deserve good options and they want good options. Even if they can't afford to shop there, they still want to believe that their side of town is deserving of those kinds of storefronts so that if they could save up, that they could spend their own money and maybe patronize those stores on occasion. And so this is the kind of difficult conundrum of why people want high quality retail, even when they can't afford it, is that high quality retail is a symbol that you are an equal participant in our consumer culture, that you get to buy if you want to and you save up, that you can buy nice things just like everyone else. But the way that our retail outlets are distributed in our country is that they're too often poor neighborhoods are kind of the dumping grounds of lousy retail. And so you've driven by a strip mall and you know right off the bat, is this a nice strip mall or is this a downscale strip mall? Just because of the combination of storefronts. That sort of social detective work is not dependent upon any kind of wealth or higher education. People can do that with their own eyes. And so people who live in areas without high quality retail know that they are not getting the types of investment from the private or public sector that they feel like is reflected in their own sense of their own community's worth.
So moving on to chapter six, and chapter six is called Problem Solvers. And this is where you kind of dive into short-term, long-term solutions that may work in order to help solve the food desert debate. Some of these things were, you know, meeting neighbors right where they needed to. Some of these were farmers markets and buying directly from farmers, urban agriculture. Is there a solution in chapter six that you think that is more long-term solution than any of the others?
The one that I'm currently pushing for is when I try and explain that policies need to account for existing resources, and then it's really great to push for wholesale investment into communities to build brand new stores or really do an ecological approach to all the types of investment that a community needs. I'm also sensitive to the need for just immediate first steps of things that communities could accomplish now. And so the one that I'm trying to press the most at the current moment is to combine fresh fruit and vegetable sales in the parking lot of dollar stores. And I know that kind of sounds a little strange, but hear me out. So when I did a lot of research on farmers markets, I would talk to the different vendors and people who organize the farmers market. And I came to understand what was driving the price up and as well as what was driving the price down. All the farmers that came to the farmers market wanted to sell all their products for as much money as they could get. This would become a problem if other farmers at the market were selling the exact same products as they did. So if everybody came in selling eggs, there's a flood of eggs on the market. There's only so much demand for eggs. So the price for eggs goes down. The organizers of the farmers market knew this. And so they would try to invite some people who sold eggs, others that sold beef, others that sold pork, others that sold honey, others that sold vegetables. They wanted a nice variety. This actually propped the prices up. Okay. And so everybody got to sell all their stuff. They leave with empty trucks and they're happy. And so this was a logic of partnering and pairing different types of retail operations so that they don't compete with one another, but yet they still see coming together to vend to sell their products as mutually beneficial. So dollar stores currently don't often sell fresh produce. Some do in pilot situations, and they've made a lot of efforts, or they made a lot of promises that they were going to in the future that haven't really panned out. But what you can mostly get at dollar stores are canned and dried goods, as well as a frozen food section and a dairy section, but you're not going to see rows of different types of lettuce or a butcher aisle with healthier cuts. Dollar stores are highly critiqued in the United States as sort of sucking up demand and preventing grocery stores from entering into markets. And there's different research on that, and I'm not entirely convinced. But politically, dollar stores understand that they're in a sensitive position, is that most people would classify them as generally not super high quality retail. They do serve a need, and they may sometimes be the only retailer in a community, but they don't necessarily sell the high quality nutritious food because it's expensive. Healthier food is more expensive per calorie. But if communities could make arrangements with dollar stores, understanding sort of their precarious public relations position right now, to get them to grant or yield a little space in their parking lots for fresh and whole food vendors to come in. This doesn't have to be organic farmers market stuff. This can be conventionally grown fruits and vegetables bought at wholesale prices and brought at regularly scheduled times outside of dollar stores, because they wouldn't actually be competing with anything that the dollar store sells. They're not trying to sell, the dollar store is not trying to sell radishes. And so if someone is outside selling radishes, the possibility that someone might come to buy that product, some healthier fresh foods, would also increase the likelihood that they're going to go inside the dollar store to buy what they always need, which is toilet paper. Every family needs toilet paper. So farmers don't, you know, we don't need to sell to try and create a partnership between two non-competing businesses. We'll increase the total traffic to both of them in a way that could be mutually beneficial. And you could kind of recreate some of the healthier aspects of grocery stores. Now, obviously, this isn't going to work from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. 7 days a week. But as long as it's regularly scheduled in a way that people can start to plan their lives around, and they know this is the one time that they could go to the dollar store this week or this window, then they could craft a life around it, and it would give them increased options. And although a full scale grocery store that had a greengrocer, a butcher, a baker, a pharmacy, all those things that we want to see in a supermarket, that would be better. That isn't coming to every community anytime soon. And so this is just a practical solution of combining and pairing existing resources in ways that are mutually beneficial to both to the retailers as well as to the customers.
Let's transition here for a minute. Now we're getting towards the end of the book. We're now in a time that we consider to be post-COVID-19. In your opinion, is there anything that you would change about your initial research?
I think the one thing that I didn't foresee was the potential benefits to some of the technological innovations in food retail distribution. So I've always been kind of leery of online grocery shopping or Blue Apron or some of these meal kits, because they can be delivered straight to the household, and they can bypass some of the distance problems or proximity issues of people with grocery stores. But those solutions always added extra costs, because the more people who touch the food that you're eventually going to eat, the more people that have to get paid. And so the person driving the truck that's shipping it somehow gets built into that cost, the wear and tear on their vehicle, their gasoline, their salary, everything. But that being said, on larger economies of scale, the market generally knows what you eat. It's a little scary. I mean, I remember about a decade ago, Target created an algorithm and could find out when people were pregnant before they even knew that they were pregnant, just by the products that they were buying and in what combination. And so the market knows how much a given community eats particular kinds of food through the use of big data. And again, this poses all sorts of privacy risks. But if you live in an apartment complex, it's likely that Amazon knows what kinds of cereal is being eaten most often within that apartment complex. With that type of information, being able to create nodes or depots or distribution points to communities, to apartment complexes, to places where people congregate together, given that with a little participation, they can define exactly what their food needs are. And it the most inefficient part of the grocery store is actually like the lighting and the music and the pretty decorations and interior decorating. Like none of that really makes any money. If you had stores that could actually be points where people could just pick up pre-arranged orders or just put into people's trunks, or that they could deliver to community centers that were refrigerated, all these types of novel and innovative distribution strategies are not impossible, because the market generally knows what we're eating. So those are the kinds of things. I always thought that it was inefficient because it would just, all that delivery and packaging and putting together orders was just going to add more costs because it added more labor. But with enough data, I think we probably could figure out much more efficient distribution systems so that people don't have to go to pristine, interiorly decorated supermarkets and have a nice shopping experience, because that shopping experience is actually what adds a lot of cost to it.
This book was a great read. It's fantastic. And it didn't take incredibly long either, which was even better, because me as a working mom, I love being able to read a book and being able to finish it front to back. But you're actually up for 2 awards for this book.
Well, it's nice. I mean, it takes a long time to write a book. And so it takes a little while for, you know, people to read it and get out there. But it was nominated as a finalist for the a James Beard Book Award in the issue of Food Issues and Advocacy. It won an honorable mention from American Sociological Association's Consumer and Consumption Committee. And it just won the book prize for the Association for the Study of Food and Society. So winning those awards, you know, it's nice. What I really want is people to read the book and feel like they can talk to their local leaders and be a little more informed about how to press for change. But to get some recognition from other, you know, academics and scholars that is worthwhile is very rewarding.
Thank you so much for joining us here today on The Ethnographic Eater, though. Your time has been greatly appreciated, and all of your information has been greatly appreciated as well. Before we do let you go, is there anywhere that our listeners could actually go and purchase your book?
Well, it's available in all the, you know, familiar online outlets. The University of California Press it's a nonprofit. And so if you buy it from them, then it goes into support more books being written on similarly important topics. Also, if you just find me on Twitter, I'm Ken H KOLB. You just follow me and I'll follow you back and I'll send you a DM with a 40% off discount code. I don't want to publish that code on the internet, but anybody who wants it, and if you really need it and you can't afford it, just send me an email and I'll send you a copy.
Thank you, Dr. Kolb, again for joining us here today. It's greatly appreciated, and I hope you have a great rest of your day.
Okay. Thanks so much for having me. This was fun.